Zero to Book is brought to you by Rainmaker FM, the digital marketing and sales podcast network. Find more great shows and education at rainmaker.fm.
A lot of people aspire to write a book. Maybe you do, but you probably know it's a complex process. Zero to Book is documenting the journey from start to finish so you can learn how to take your book from an idea to a published product. Listen in as best-selling author Jeff Goins helps Pamela Wilson go from zero to book.
Jeff, today I wanted to talk to you about structure, book structure, and I have this funny feeling that this episode is going to be more therapeutic for you than it is for me. Because yeah. I know you've just been through this big thing with the book that you're writing.
Right.
And it had to do with the structure. So you and I were talking about this episode and you told me that you had developed this new theory of the universe of nonfiction yeah. books. So I thought we should talk about that. I love the theory. So you basically said that most nonfiction books fit into one of two formats. So do you want to elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't think anybody's talking about this. And I think that most people think a book gets written, you just sit down and you write it. And the truth is that that happens, but that's not the way a good book gets written. The way a good book typically gets written is you sit down and you come up with a great idea. We've talked about this before. And then you figure out, how am I going to present this idea? And the idea could be, you suck at copywriting. Here's how to get a little bit better at copywriting following this five-step method. Or the idea could be, you know, earth-shattering, universe-shaking. But the point is, you're trying to communicate something. And, you know, the way that you do it is really important. And I've written, I'm in the, you know, process of finishing up my fifth book. And I will admit that, like, the first few books, I was just sort of fumbling my way through it. But the whole time, I was grasping for a structure. You know, and we've heard the saying before that good artists copy, great artists steal. It's been attributed to Picasso. But this is what, like, really good writers do, is they look at what other writers have done and they steal it. They steal the structure. They steal the format. Fiction writers do this all the time. They match the plot points beat for beat. Screenwriters do this. And I have this belief that really successful nonfiction writers do that as well. They take something that somebody else has done and they put their own spin on it, or they curate five of their top influences and they put it together into this thing that everybody goes, oh, that's so original. That's their style. And really they're just stealing other, you know, formats.
Okay. So I have to stop you there though. I come from a design background where you're stealing without even knowing you're stealing, because
you're
just like picking up influences from the whole world around you, and somehow those influences make their way into your visual work. So before we continue, I just want to talk a little bit about, like, should people feel guilty about this, or is this just part of the creative process?
It is the creative process. Creativity is stealing.
Mm.
There is no way to create something without borrowing from somebody else. And, you know, you can think of it as there's nothing new under the sun. You can think of it as, you know, the scientifically, what do they call this, multiple discovery?
Right.
It's been demonstrated that, like, two people on separate sides of the world at the same time can come up with the same idea.
That's why we have people who win the Nobel Prize for Science for two discoveries that happened in the same year in two different, completely different parts of the world.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a mystery. Elizabeth Gilbert in her book Big Magic has a fascinating sort of spiritual explanation for it, where she says, like, you know, the ideas come to you if you know do something with the idea. The idea metaphysically moves to somebody else. I don't know. You know, so there's lots of spiritual explanations, there's scientific ones, but the bottom line is what makes work interesting is not that the work, we talked about this a long time ago when we talked about coming up with your big idea. It's not that it's original. It's not that it's quote unquote good. It's that, you know, it's interesting that there's something familiar about your idea, but then there's some kind of unique twist on it, right? And so what do you do when you come up with an interesting idea? You're saying, you've heard this, but now I tell you this. You're starting with something familiar and you're building upon it. And I think creativity is just stealing. But if you borrow from enough places, you're going to come up with something that looks kind of original. And I think actually is innovative. You know, you can add something unique because, like you said, once you kind of scour all these influences and you borrow this from that and learn that from so-and-so and you get this from, you know, life experience, it starts to kind of take on a life of its own and you start to get opinions about art or form or style, whatever your craft is, and that it begins to take shape. But I don't know of a way to create anything, Pamela, without stealing, because what are you going to do? You're going to sit in a vacuum somewhere and not look at anything, listen to anything, watch anything, and create something?
Well, and things, I mean, the final product ends up being richer when there are some pieces that are somewhat familiar. I like to think of it like, you know, someone gives you a big box of Legos, all different right. colors, all different shapes, and the way you put them together, I mean, everybody has the same box of Legos, but everyone puts them together in a different combination, a different form, uses different colors, the end product is something different, so... you know, there may be pieces of other people's ideas, but what you do with them is always something original.
That's well said.
It's influenced by everything. It's influenced by the creation itself, but it's also influenced by the way you approach things and your way of thinking and structuring and all of that. So I never feel bad about those things. I mean,
yeah, I don't either.
I just always think it's kind of funny. It's like, oh, now I see where I got that from.
Right,
you know,
right.
Every once in a while you'll see that you picked up something, but it's almost impossible to avoid, really. If you have your eyes open and you're participating in the world, you're going to pick up influences.
That's right. Yeah. And I like the Lego analogy because it is possible for two people with the same set of little bricks to make the same thing, but it's highly unlikely. And if you are gathering a lot of Legos, you're consuming a lot of content, you're learning, which is really important. It's a really important part of the creative process. The more Legos you gather, the more interesting and original your work is going to look because you're not just copying one person. You know, you're
right.
copying 100. And it does, as you put those pieces together, people go, oh, wow, I never would have thought of making that. So I love that analogy for that reason. And also because nobody looks at something, I don't look at the car that my son, you know, builds with his Legos. He does this every day and go, that's not original because you stole those Legos. Like those, you didn't make those Legos. No, like that's the craft, is taking things that have already been made and turning them into something else.
My son used to get those Lego sets, those super expensive ones, you know, like
oh, yeah.
the Star
uh-huh.
Wars ones.
Me too.
And uh-huh. Yeah. And he would build the model once. Only once. And then after that, it was just like riffing on all those parts
cool.
and putting
yeah.
them together differently. And what he would end up creating would be so much more interesting than the model on the box, I always thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right. So let's figure out how the Lego pieces morph into your book, because I loved this theory that you gave me about nonfiction books and how they seem to boil down, most of them anyway, boil down to one of two formats.
I challenge somebody to contradict me on this. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't think I am. I don't hear anybody talking about structure, like proven structures for books. And so what I'm always looking for, because I'm always stealing, I'm looking for something that works, you know? And you see this a lot in fiction. There are systematic ways to tell a story. If you follow those rules, it works. The story works. If you don't, it doesn't work. And you can mess with that structure once you understand it. You can learn the rules to break the rules. But if you don't know the rules, create nonsense. We don't talk about this as much in the sort of nonfiction, persuasive, argumentative, big idea, or how-to space. So I'm not talking about memoir. I'm not talking about literary genres. I'm talking about you're going to write a business book, a personal development book, a how-to book, a book about advice, or you know, an experience that you have and you learned some lessons. The bulk of you know what we think of when we think of nonfiction. I've studied a lot. I have with this most recent book, I finally figured out, like, because I'm just obsessed with structure. And some people don't think about this. I think about it because I have to understand the form that I'm using before I start riffing. I have to understand what's in the box before I even can imagine innovating. Some people don't have to worry about it. They just create it, or the process is intuitive to them. But I think it's really good to understand what are the basic structures for nonfiction books, and then what can you do with those? If you don't do this, chances are you're going to waste a lot of words. So what are those structures? Okay, I think there's two. And I started writing this book, and the book that I'm working on right now, and I started writing it one way, and I realized it didn't serve the argument. And so I had to kind of scrap it. I had all my content, but I had to scrap it and rewrite every chapter to build the argument a different way.
That must have been frustrating. The therapy part of this episode.
Is it frustrating? Yeah, sure. I mean, it was frustrating, but it was also a relief because I realized I was forcing an argument into a structure that would not support it.
Okay. And at what point did you realize that? Is that something you realized with your editor, or is that something? Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I just wondered if you kind of felt it in your gut as you were putting it together.
I'm always, like, you know, full of self-doubt with a book, and I try to trust myself. But I need eyes on the manuscript. It is not a private process for me. It is and it isn't. Stephen King says you write the first draft with the door closed, the second draft with the door open. So you start, you get words on a paper, the vomit draft, you know, kind of by yourself, you know, away from the scrutiny of the world. But then once it turns into something, you need help. You need to figure out what makes sense, what doesn't, because you're so close to the work. You don't understand really what you're communicating. Remember in high school when you, like, took a communication class and or speech class or whatever, and they explained what communication actually was, and they're like, okay, you've got a sender and you've got the message and you've got a receiver, and it's not communication until the sender sends the message and the receiver actually receives it. How does the sender know that the receiver received the message? They get feedback. They go, okay, I got it, or I'll do that, or
I understood, right?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And until you have that, you have not made a connection. You've not communicated. So a lot of writers are writing, but they're not communicating. And I think this is essential to writing. William Zinsser talks about this on Writing Well. Writing, first and foremost, is about communication, clarity. That's your job, not to be clever, but to be clear. Anyway,
I have to give you, I actually saved a quote from that book that I was going to try to insert into one of these episodes. So, and it's, every successful piece of nonfiction should leave the reader with one provocative thought that he or she didn't have before, which I thought was perfect.
That book is so good.
It is so good. Every single page is great.
It's like a style guide. It should be the most boring book in the world, and it's so well written.
Yes, I agree. All right, so we keep getting off track. So I'm sure people are just, you know, waiting with bated breath. So two ways to write a nonfiction book, the majority of nonfiction books. And the first is...
The first is what I call... The arc method. So you think of your argument like a narrative arc, like a story. It doesn't mean that it actually has to be a story, although this works too, but it has to work like a story. How does a story work? Well, you start with the problem. You create conflict that sort of heightens and heightens and heightens until it gets to a climax. Then there's a resolution, and, you know, all is well in the world. And I mean, that's sort of an oversimplified process. There's lots of different ways to approach storytelling. But the bottom line is you start with a problem, you eventually offer a solution, and then you identify the implications of that solution. It's an arc.
So that arc stretches across the entire book, correct?
So what that means practically is you cannot read one or two chapters of this book and get the idea. Mm. It doesn't work that way. What it typically means is you're going to start with chapter one, and that's going to be the problem. And chapter one is going to hook you and lead into chapter two. And chapter two is going to talk about maybe even how the problem gets a little bit worse. And it's going to tease out, you know, solutions, practical things that can help you with this, or if it's a, you know, if it's academic in nature, it's going to share kind of the implicit hope, because you're writing this thing not to just say, hey, this is a problem, but hey, this is a problem. We need to do something about it. And here's a new idea, or a bunch of old ideas that look new, that address this situation in some way that hasn't been addressed before. I mean, that's the bottom line, that if you want to write a book about anything, you have to say something new. And this is ironic because we just talked about stealing, but that something new may just be like connecting all of these dots in a way that's never been connected before, or connect, or saying everything that everybody's already said before and then say, here's what I think about all that. That person's wrong. This person's kind of right, you know, whatever. But you have to do something useful and interesting and novel about your subject. Otherwise, why write the book? This is where, you know, like all the things that we tell writers, like this is where the rubber meets the road. Where, you know, you write up, you got a book and you need to write it, like go be creative. All those things are great. But when it comes to actually shipping something, this better be worth it. And all right. That means is that you're saying something that this reader, it could just be one reader, but you're saying something for the reader that they've not heard before. You're doing it in a way that they've not heard before. And so that's really important. So the arc is, you know, chapter one is the problem. Chapter two is maybe exacerbating the problem, teasing out the solution. Chapter three, you're offering hope for, you know, a new way of doing this. This is not a hard and fast structure, but you're building up to a climax, and then, you know, the action is going to fall and there's going to be a resolution. It's a story.
So you really, in order to get the takeaways from this kind of a book, you really have to read the whole thing front to back.
You do.
Okay. Yep, absolutely. And so I'm listening to this. It's making me feel just slightly nervous, because that doesn't describe the book that I just finished writing the first draft of at all. So I'm curious to know what this second structure is.
So you asked if I was, you know, if that made me frustrated. It ended up making me relieved, because I started with this most recent book, and I've written books that fit into both of these categories. I've done it knowingly and unknowingly, but they, you know, roughly fit into one of these two categories. And you can write this way without realizing. A lot of people do. But I was starting with the arc structure, because I love that. I love a good Malcolm Gladwell book. This is a great example, because you do not get the point of a book like Blink. I mean, this to me, Blink is Gladwell's least easy to understand book. I remember getting to the end of the book and going, well, wait a second, what's the point?
Right.
And you get it in the conclusion. The conclusion or epilogue or whatever is called Three Lessons of Blink.
Right.
And he just tells you all these stories about, here's when you should trust your intuition. Okay, great. Trust my intuition. Listen to my gut. Good. Here's when you shouldn't trust your intuition. Oh gosh, I, you know, like, what's the simple idea that I could get in my brain?
Right.
It's not very clear until the end. And he says, well, in this situation, here's what works, but in this situation, here's what works. And, you know, and here's how to know the difference. You know, okay, cool. You do not get that in, you know, the middle of chapter three. Compare that with a book like The 4-Hour Workweek, both very successful, you know, nonfiction books. And it's very different. You open up, you know, chapter two of the 4-Hour Workweek, and you could read just that and go, okay, I know how to be more productive, and I know how to get more work done in less time. There's no right or wrong way, but an arc written book, you know, an arc structure has to be tight. Like you have to be good. I mean, you have to be probably a better writer, or at least more conscious of how to tie ideas together, continue creating momentum, hooking the reader, not letting them go. Every time you close a loop, you have to open another one.
Yeah, and you have to do that across a lot of words. So right. I could see how that would be. And I almost wonder if that kind of book is easier to write if you do have like 2 or 3 weeks blocked out to only work on your book, because it would just be easier to keep the whole thing in your head as you're writing it. But all right, so that's we talked about the narrative arc, and then you have this other, what are you calling the second structure, which definitely sounds more like the book that I wrote.
I call it the modular structure, the modular format.
Because each piece of the book really is almost like a lesson, like a standalone lesson.
It's a module, yeah. Yeah, it's a, and here's how this works, okay? You still should probably read the whole book, but you don't necessarily have to. And here's how I knew I was trying to do both of these things at once. And this is something that we hear, I think, a lot when we talk about any kind of structure, any kind of format. Can I do both? No, you can't do both because it's going to confuse the reader. I know this because I did this. And I sent the manuscript to my editor. And he said, okay, when you started the introduction, you set me up for this promise that you were going to teach me step by step how to fix this problem. But then I read chapter one and there was no step. There was no solution.
No. Right. Like,
it was just a bunch of stories woven together.
Right.
And that was heartbreaking because chapter one was 8,000 words.
Oh, no. Yeah.
And I was like, I'm trying to be Malcolm Gladwell. Why isn't it working? And so I had to scrap it. And I took a 10 chapter book, just weaving stories together, trying to create this arc to just say this interesting thing. Cause I was so close to the data and the research and, you know, and the ideas and the stories that I just thought, oh, this is beautiful. I was saying nothing really beautifully, but the rubber met the road when, my editor said, is this what you want to say? Is this what you want the book to do? And I was like, no, I want the book to help the reader do X. And he said, well, this doesn't do that. So why don't you just do this, you know, like, why don't you just take chapter one and call it rule number one?
Yeah.
And we took a bunch of stories and we turned them into, there's still stories, there's still narrative, I'm still weaving themes throughout it, but each chapter, you know, is now a standalone thing. So
it's more self-contained, it sounds like.
3,000 to 4,000 words, 17 chapters.
Yeah.
And so the modular format is the modular structure typically starts with an introduction or chapter one, however you want to do that. And there's the big idea. And then the rest of the book is about how to apply that big idea. Step one, step two, step three. It could be persuasive. Here's the fight that I want to pick. And then reason one, reason two, reason three. So you tend to kind of bring up the big idea at the beginning of the book and you spend the rest of the book just explaining it, you know,
right.
just applying and explaining. And then the end of the book kind of wraps everything up. So, you know, and so great books like this are really popular books like this are going to be the 4-Hour Work Week. 48 Laws of Power is a very great example of this because it's so tight. Every chapter has the same format. There's this law. There's a story. There's an interpretation of the story. Then there's the application. Then there's the reversal. Here's when it doesn't work. Then we move on to the next law. And it's like your book is, at least my understanding, because I haven't looked at it yet, is like at any time you can open this book and go to chapter 36 and go, okay, that's going to help me fix this thing right here. And it'd be good to read the whole book, but it's also, it's very accessible. It's you know, it's a resource reference piece, and whenever you get stuck, you can easily go back to certain segment of the book and read it, and not go, well, what are they talking about here? I gotta, you know, go back and see what's happening in the story.
Yeah, that's what I'm going for. That is exactly what I'm going for. So, it's interesting to know that it has its own validity. You know, that it has a structure that is valid and has been used in other popular books and that works. I can't imagine presenting the information that I wanted to present with a narrative arc. I mean, I did weave in stories, but they're a lot more self-contained. There's not like this overall narrative arc from start to finish, except for maybe like, if I did this, you can do this too. That might be my narrative arc, but
yeah. And it doesn't have to be a story, but the argument has to arc.
Yes.
You start with the problem. You make the problem worse until you know, you get to the solution. It's kind of like copywriting. It's like a sales letter. A lot of copywriters love studying storytelling because it's all about the call to action. So
right.
You don't look at paragraph 3 of, you know, a blog post or a sales letter or a sales page and go, "Oh, cool, I got that. I'm going to take away that nugget." The whole point of it is line by line, we're getting you to this point where you go, "Oh, I got it." And you convert or you don't. You have to make a decision. And that's what this book is about, you know, or a book that does this, that follows the arc structure. You're just getting them to the end. And they go, oh, wow, that is so interesting. Or she is so right. And again, there's no right or wrong way to do it. But it just depends on the argument and what you really want to say and what you really want to do in the reader, you know, you're going to have to choose one or the other. Again, you know, like maybe there are variations of these and you know, subcategories, but I think most books that are comprehensible, that you can understand and are effective, because you could write a really bad book that doesn't do this, but I think good books that are how-to, advice, I guess even narrative nonfiction memoir would fit into the art category. So any nonfiction book is going to follow one of these structures pretty well. And like any structure, you can twist it, you can tweak it, you can mess with it a little bit.
Well, and it sounds to me like that's what you're doing. You yep. ended up writing a book that's modular, but you are going to use elements of the narrative arc.
I am. Yep.
Yeah. That's very cool. So it sounds to me also like it would be smart if somebody kept these things in mind as they're approaching their subject and just sort of said to themselves, like, I need to choose a path here.
Right. Yeah.
And that way they don't end up pulling apart something they've worked a long time on.
let my pain be a guide to you.
Some lessons you have to learn the hard way, right? So it sounds like you came to a really important realization. I think it's fascinating that you realized by doing this that there are these main two formats that most books follow. And I do think it's probably going to help a lot of people to recognize that.
Yeah. And once I started writing in this new structure, I mean, it just locked in. There was a momentum. There was an energy for me and writing it. I just realized this works. This is what this needs to be. Whereas doing the arc thing was fun and it you know, looked pretty, but it was convoluted and I was constantly getting stuck in the process. Because what I wanted to do was I wanted to teach the reader how to follow a series of steps that was going to result in a transformation. And typically, I think the arc structure is going to lend itself to more persuasive books where you're talking more about why, and you can still teach and, you know, tell it. Give people practical things, and the modular structure is going to lend itself more to the how-to, you know, how to do this. And I think most books, you're going to have to major in one and minor in the other. You're going to major in the why and minor in the how, you know. So Malcolm Gladwell spends an entire book talking about your intuition, and then in the conclusion says, here's what you can do with this, really. Or you're going to very quickly, you know, warm people up with the why and then spend the rest of the book talking about the how, as Tim Ferriss does in The 4-Hour Workweek.
Right.
Here's why people hate their jobs, because work is something that, you know, you shouldn't have to do for work's sake. So minimize the time you can work so you can maximize, you know, everything else. And here's how to do this. Strategy one, strategy two. Like, it's just every chapter is this short little standalone thing that you go, okay, I can apply this right now.
Love it. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that you learned a hard lesson, but you were willing to share it. I think it's going to help a lot of people as they're thinking about their book structure.
Yeah. Well, I hope so.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Jeff. And we will be back on the next episode with more fun stuff. If you have not left a review for Zero to Book, take a moment and do that. We'd love to read your reviews and we appreciate them so much, and they help others to find the podcast. So leave a review and we will read it and appreciate every single word. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.